The Lisa Wexler Show podcast is brought to you by Jill Zarin Rugs. Did you know that Jill Zarin Rugs are water-resistant and pet-friendly? Go to jillzarin.com and use the promo code FRIENDOFLISAWEXLER for an additional 10% off. Also brought to you by Onboard Services. For your staffing and engineering needs, go to onboardusa.com.
It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
And welcome to the show today. It's 6 minutes after 10. We've got another great show for you today, and you're welcome to be a part of it at 203-333-9422. There's a lot going on nationally. Let me just give you a couple of headlines. Nancy Pelosi has announced that she is not going to go the tit-for-tat legal route in terms of arguing the authority of Congress versus the White House, which is stonewalling its efforts to answer questions vis-a-vis an impeachment inquiry. So instead of fighting it in the courts, Nancy Pelosi has announced that after what seems like weeks of closed-door sessions and conversations that we were only privy to via leaks or via reporters who were allowed some information, it looks like the whole thing is going public. It's going public soon. There will no doubt be a House vote as to whether or not to take up the impeachment inquiry. And so one of the criticisms that had been leveled against the Democrats was that too much of this was happening behind closed doors. And a bunch of that were the reasons, the legalistic reasons, why the Trump administration refused to cooperate. So Nancy Pelosi said, we're not going to fight this in court. Instead, we're just going to go to the people. So get ready for that. And in terms of the latest news development on the impeachment inquiry, the most significant development is that a White House national security official who was a decorated Iraq war veteran plans to tell the House impeachment investigators today in Congress that he heard President Trump appeal to Ukraine's president to investigate one of his leading political rivals, i.e. Joe Biden, and that this aide considered the request so damaging that he reported it to a superior. One wonders whether he is in fact the whistleblower, though he has not been designated as such. No one has outed the original whistleblower yet. But the guy's name is Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, and he is of the Army. He's the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council. Twice, apparently, he internally said he was not happy about how Mr. Trump and his inner circle were treating Ukraine. He said out of his own sense of duty, he plans to tell the inquiry that this is the reason why he told on them. He will be the first White House official to testify who actually listened in on that infamous July 25th phone call between Mr. Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. That phone call is at the center of the impeachment inquiry, in which Mr. Trump asked Mr. Zelensky to investigate former VP Joe Biden Jr. in connection with activities of his son Hunter. And Colonel Vindman said in a statement that was already published. In other words, he is planning to read this statement today in Congress, but in advance of that, he released the statement to the press. And in that statement, in writing, he says, I did not think it was proper to demand that a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen. And I was worried about the implications for the U.S. government's support of Ukraine. I realized that if Ukraine pursued an investigation into the Bidens and Burisma, that's the company that Hunter Biden was a board member of, it would likely be interpreted as a partisan play, which would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing the bipartisan support it has thus far maintained. In other words, he was worried that all of this would inevitably endure to the detriment of Ukraine itself, and he felt, as a State Department official, former Iraqi decorated war vet, that was not his job, and that was a misuse and abuse of the power of the presidency. He was worried about national security. The colonel is a Ukrainian-American immigrant who received a Purple Heart after he was wounded in Iraq by a roadside bomb. His statement is full of references to duty and patriotism, and people are predicting that his witness account will be very difficult to dismiss. In fact, he plans to tell the investigators, I am a patriot, and it is my sacred duty and honor to advance and defend our country, irrespective of party or politics. He was to be interviewed privately today by the House Intelligence, Foreign Affairs, and Oversight and Reform Committees, and we know that our own Congressman Jim Himes is a member of that committee, and he is the first White House official to defy the White House orders that have ordered people in the White House not to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry. The colonel is represented by Michael Volkov, a former federal prosecutor. So that is the news to watch today. That statement, although, again, it's still behind closed doors. But what's happening is, even though it's behind closed doors, the case is being put together. So that's one headline I wanted to let you know. And then I want to turn to something far more local, 203-333-9422. And it has to do with Hamden. And it has to do with a case that the big picture. So here's the big picture. The big picture is that in this country, and we saw that President Trump was in Chicago yesterday, and that created its own storm of controversy. The big picture is that in this country, we have always had, and we will always have, I think, a tension between a policeman's duty to keep law and order and what is the reasonable use of force within that interaction between the police and a civilian. And there's always a tension. And in fact, that's why there are laws in this country. New York has one, which is called a duty to retreat. Not every state has it. But there are laws that developed over time in response to actions of police brutality or what they call excessive force. And so, for example, the law in New York says that if a police officer is in the middle of a crime, investigating a crime in the middle of chase, and the person on the other side doesn't have a weapon and runs away, that the police officer has a duty to retreat. In other words, a duty to let them run away. Now you say, well, how can that be? How can they get away with a crime? In real life, it doesn't happen like that. Well, the idea is that police are not supposed to shoot at unarmed civilians. And that if you have to balance and compete in weighing the public interest between letting somebody in the heat of the moment get away with it and run away versus shooting someone in the back who is unarmed, not somebody who presents a clear and present danger to the police officer, but someone unarmed who's running away, society has judged in many states that it's better off to let the person get away with that crime and fine them another day rather than shoot an unarmed civilian in the back. And again, you might not agree with that. And every state doesn't have that law, but a lot of states do. It's called a duty to retreat. In other words, the police have a duty not to use excessive force. And how that duty plays out in the statute, plays out in the cases, differs. It differs among communities. It differs among states. So we have, and of course, we have this movement called Black Lives Matters for a reason. And the reason that we have it is because we had a succession of cases in which black people were killed by police in the course of an interaction with police, where later it was found to have been that the person either didn't have a weapon with them at the time, or that the use of force was excessive in comparison to the crime that was being investigated. In other words, if somebody is stealing from a Walmart, do they deserve to get killed for it? Let's assume they're guilty. Let's assume they're running away with the stolen goods, but they have no weapon. Do they deserve to get killed? Is that a punishment that fits the crime, even if, yes, they are running away from police and they don't put their hands up? These are the kind of things. And so the Black Lives Matter movement arose with this perception that there were too many incidents in which the racial composition of the victim determined the outcome of the interaction with police. That in too many times, if somebody was black, they weren't given the benefit of the doubt by police, whereas if they were white, they were. So if they were black and they emerged from a car and one hand was down and one hand was up, maybe they'd get shot. But if they were white and one hand was down and one hand was up, maybe the police would say once again, put your hands up before shooting. Now, we've got a situation in Hamden. In April of 2019, I downloaded the arrest warrant because the news is that Devlin Eaton, who was a member of the Hamden Police Force, was officially arrested. And, in fact, yesterday turned himself in on an arraignment. And there were protests in Hamden about this. We're going to come back. We're going to hear a little bit of audio from some of the protests. We're going to get into some of the details of the arrest warrant. Because this is a case that is a local case. It happened right here in Hamden. And I think the facts bear examination so that you and I can continue to have a conversation about this, about the interaction between the police and civilians, about our priorities as a community, about what is justice in this situation. And believe me, it's not so black and white. There are areas of gray. So let's talk about it. Let's be real grown-ups and talk about this. At 203-333-9422 on the Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be right back. And welcome back. 203-333-9422. So let's hear a little bit. Christian, let's play cut one. Now, this is about the Hamden officer whose name is Devin Eaton, who is facing charges with respect to an April shooting.
There's been a lag in these local investigations, one upon the city of Hamden, two upon Yale University. There's been no transparency in these investigations, so we're calling for immediate action and immediate discharge.
And that was Kerry Ellington, the organizer of protests that took place last night. Cut three, a little bit more.
We understand that the Hamden Police Union contract allows the Hamden Police Commission, at this point that Devin Eaton has felony charges, it allows the police commission to meet within 10 days of the officer having felony charges and to make a disposition.
And that, again, was Kerry Ellington basically urging the police, now that the arrest warrant has been issued, now that there's been an arraignment, now that there are formal charges, he would like to see further internal disciplinary action. Let's go to cut three. I mean, cut two, pardon me.
Justice for Stephanie!
Justice for Stephanie!
Justice for Paul!
Justice for Paul!
Okay, so now let's talk about this, because now I want to tell you the facts of what happened that night. And I'm curious to know what side you're on. Just tell me. 203-333-9422. So here's what happened. And this is according to the arrest warrant, which I'm taking at face value. It hasn't been proven. It's an allegation. And obviously, Mr. Eaton will have a chance to defend. And to the extent that the facts here are not what he remembered or what he thinks to be true, he'll have a chance to tell you in court. But this is a signed affidavit by the police department, by Patrick Griffin, in the name of the prosecuting authority, in an arrest warrant for Devin Eaton, who is a police officer with the Connecticut's police officer with Hamden. And and here's what they say. This is what they say. They say this. On 4/16/2016, at approximately 5:16 a.m., and I always look at the time of date of these things because my sister always used to say nothing good happens after midnight. Well, 5:16 a.m., it's not exactly midnight, but it's not exactly rush hour either. The Connecticut State Police was requested by the New Haven State's Attorney's Office to assist in the investigation of an officer-involved shooting that occurred on Argyle Street near its intersection with Dixwell Avenue in New Haven. You know where Dixwell Avenue is in New Haven? It's a pretty big street. And here's what happened. And so the assistance came from the Connecticut State Police at 5:16 a.m. But at 4:20 a.m., now you're talking about the middle of the night, when rarely good things ever happen, right? 4:20 a.m. The Hamden Police Department received a 911 call from a clerk at the Go-On gas station at the Whitestone Mini Mart at 144 Arch Street in Hamden. The clerk reported that outside of the gas station, an African-American male customer with dreadlocks was driving a red car with a license plate and had a female passenger. And the clerk reported that a gun was pulled on the newspaper delivery man, asking him for money. The clerk also said the African-American man was harassing a second customer. The clerk reiterated the suspect and vehicle information, giving the officer the license plate number, and provided the direction of travel when the suspect left the gas station. So, HPD officers Devin Eaton and Karen Bryce were dispatched to go to the Go-On Gas 144 Arch Street. And they have different signals and different codes. And they used the signal 128, signifying to the officers, the police officers, that there was a weapon involved, a firearm. The dispatch told the officers the vehicle description, the registration plate, the suspect description, also that there was a female in the vehicle, which reportedly fled the gas station. So let's now talk about what it is. So right away, the police officers are informed a couple of things. Number one, there could have been an armed robbery or burglary, because when we say robbery, we usually mean a lot of money. But in any event, that there is a gun and that a person is running away, presumably from a gas station, after trying to get some money. Okay? That's what they believe they know to be true. Also, when they did the license plate, they said that the registration came back and that what they should be looking for was a 1999 red two-door Honda Civic that was registered in West Haven. All right, now, at 4:24 a.m., they notified the New Haven Police Department via the hotline that they just had, quote, this is a quote, a street robbery happened in our town, was heading in your direction on Dixwell Avenue with a gun used in a street robbery. And they further gave the officers all of the information. It turned out later everything that they told the officers was true, except there was one digit off in the license plate. The New Haven Police Department radio broadcast can also be heard by Yale University Police Department. That's important because there's a second officer that's involved in this. And so if they want to, Yale University Police Department can turn on the same audio, and they heard this too. So at 4:32 a.m., again, you're talking the middle of the night, right? Officer Eaton and Yale Police Officer Terrence Pollock encountered the stated red Honda Civic on Argyle Street near its intersection with Dixwell Avenue in New Haven, and they found that it was occupied by two people, a Paul Witherspoon and a front seat passenger, Stephanie Washington. Then the arrest warrant goes on to talk about what the video surveillance footage showed, and upon reviewing it, they say that Officer Pollock's marked YPD cruiser, the Yale Police Department cruiser, was stopped with its lights off on the shoulder of Dixwell Avenue, and Officer Eaton was driving a marked cruiser. In other words, people knew that it was police, passing Officer Pollock and Argyle Street. And then Officer Eaton slowed and performed a U-turn. Officer Pollock performed a U-turn, and it looks like basically they're trying to make sure that this car knows that the police are following it or the police are after it, and they're trying to get it into a place where the person has to stop. Okay, now here's what happens here. And then they talk about which way they were going before they came to a stop, Here's where, this is what happens. Once on Argyle Street, Officer Eaton slowly passed the red Honda Civic and pulled toward the driver's side rear of the vehicle. Officer Eaton stopped his cruiser, opened his door, exited, and drew his service weapon. In other words, he came out of his car with his weapon pointed. The driver's door of the Honda opened. Paul Witherspoon started to exit the vehicle while raising his hands. Officer Eaton, now this is according to the arrest warrant, Officer Eaton fired toward Witherspoon. Listening, somebody comes out of the car with his hands up, and the police officer fired his weapon anyway. When Witherspoon was shot at, he goes back into his car, and Officer Eaton continues to fire. In fact, we find out eventually that he fired 13 shots from his gun. Officer Eaton moves to the rear, and then he goes to the passenger side. There's a girl in the passenger side. She's not accused of holding up anyone, but she's in the car with Witherspoon. And maybe she was an accomplice. Who knows? She might have been in the car. Well, she was in the car reportedly when, again, we're talking about something that happens at a gas station. Somebody shows a weapon, asks somebody for money, and then speeds away. That's all the police know. But that's enough to tell them that there could be a weapon and they could be in danger or other people could be in danger. Who knows? Okay. But nonetheless, Eaton starts firing first, again, according to the warrant. And then he goes around and he shoots through the passenger side. He shoots the passenger. Officer Pollock, in the meantime, had exited his cruiser and he fired one shot. and he didn't put his vehicle's transmission in park. So his car rolled forward and struck the front end of the red Honda Civic. And then Officer Pollock fired a second shot, and then he fired a third shot. But in total, Officer Eaton filed 13 shots in the direction, and Pollock filed three. So 16 bullets were fired, and there was no weapon at all from Witherspoon or the passenger. The Go On Gas store clerk was transported to the scene, and he definitively identified Witherspoon and Washington. And he specifically identified Witherspoon as the individual involved in the incident with the newspaper delivery person. And he also identified the car. Stephanie Washington suffered multiple injuries in this incident. She had a gunshot wound in the left upper thigh glute area, which traveled left to right. It fractured her pelvis and spine. She had bullet fragments exiting her right flank through two exit wounds. She then went by hospital to Yale Hospital and was eventually discharged on 4/20/2019. Paul Witherspoon, believe it or not, was not injured at all. Officer Pollock sustained a gunshot graze wound to his right calf, which was the result of, quote, friendly fire. In other words, he got shot by the other officer, Officer Eaton. And that's basically the facts. And other than the firearms belonging to the officers, investigators did not find any additional firearms at the scene. And specifically, the arrest warrant says that no firearm was visible in plain view inside the red Honda Civic. So let me ask you this. And then there are other facts here. For example, Witherspoon has not allowed the police officers into his iPhone, so they have not been able to crack the phone. A search and seizure warrant for the red Honda Civic showed that no firearm was located, but showed that a lot of bullet holes had hit that car. There was a lot of footage, a lot of video surveillance, a lot of audio surveillance. And the bottom line is that Witherspoon said, quote, that he had watched many movies in his life, and he knew that even if he scratched his private part, he would have been shot, so he kept his hands out. And he said as he was getting out of the car, he looked to his rear and he saw the police officer standing there and the barrel of the gun pointed straight at him. The police officer then opened fire at him. That is his statement. And that appears to be borne up by the arrest warrant. So let me ask you this, 203-333-9422. We have an officer, Officer Eaton, and he thinks that there is a robbery in place with a gun because that's what he's told and that's what dispatch tells him. Is there any scenario in which I've just told you the facts that you think that Officer Eaton was justified in what he did? When you listen to this, because, for example, there are people that will hear these facts, and this is what they'll say. They'll say, it's very easy to have 20/20 hindsight. I wasn't there. You weren't there. The police are there. They're trained. And in the moment in which they are chasing a would-be perpetrator with a weapon, they have to try and defend themselves and defend the public. And so every time, this is what some people will say, every time we arrest a police officer, we are demotivating the rest of the police force. We are giving the police force a message that they shouldn't fight too hard or work too hard to defend us, because if they do, they're only going to go to jail for it. There are people who say that all the time. There are people who would rather err on the side of, yes, occasionally there will be friendly fire, and yes, occasionally there will be excessive force, but on the whole, we have to defend our police. That if they do what they do in the heat of the moment, even if it's an error, they shouldn't be arrested for it. There are people that believe that. What do you think? 203-333-9422. What do you think? Do you think that the commission of what others judge to be excessive force is something that should be fully prosecuted? Do you think that it is in all of our interests to rid ourselves of police officers who, in the heat of battle, in the heat of moment, do the wrong thing and fire on people that don't have any obvious weapon around them? And in this scenario, what if Officer Eaton says, you know what, it's true, Mr. Witherspoon didn't have any gun pointed at me, but I was told there was a gun, and I was afraid that someone else in the vehicle was going to shoot at me, and I thought I saw something, or I thought I heard something. We don't know what his defense is going to be. 203-333-9422. This is a local case. This is Hamden. What do you think? WICC 600, WICC600.com on the Lisa Wexler Show. At 203-333-9422, we were discussing the use of excessive force, 203-333-9422, right before we came on board. We were discussing, in fact, the protests that have been going on in Hamden. I can almost hear what you're thinking, you know, because it's 4 a.m. in the morning and Stephanie Washington gets in the front seat of a car with a guy named Paul Witherspoon. And it appears as if they went to a gas station to try and get some money. Obviously, it doesn't look like they did show a gun. Something must have been wrong there. Or, I mean, it's possible that they ditched it before the police got to their car. I suppose that's possible, but there's no evidence of that. So maybe it was just wrong to begin with. Maybe the whole fact pattern was wrong. Maybe Paul Witherspoon doesn't have a record and has never been in trouble in his life, and there was a misunderstanding, and who knows? We'll find out more. But what the police reasonably believed, because the dispatch told them, was that they were chasing somebody en route from a possible robbery attempt that had a weapon. And that upon stopping that vehicle, with Paul Witherspoon having his arms up, Officer Eaton opened fire. Now, he missed Mr. Witherspoon. He fired 13 times, and Mr. Witherspoon, in the end, didn't have a scratch on him. But Stephanie, the passenger in the front seat, she got hurt pretty bad. And the Yale officer also got grazed with a bullet. Let's go to James from West Haven. Hi, James. Thanks for calling in today. I'd really like to know, what do you make of these facts? What goes through your head in terms of, as a community, what we should be prioritizing, what we should be thinking about?
Well, I'm a law-abiding citizen, and I think I deserve the right to drive home after being a law-abiding citizen my whole life. And just because a police officer gets some information and mistakenly thinks that I'm somebody who perpetrated the crime, I think I deserve the right to go home safely without a trigger, happy or nervous. I mean, maybe nervous police officer opening fire on me. That's not protecting me.
Yeah.
That's the way I feel about it. I deserve the right to go home.
Yep.
Just because he got his information wrong does not mean
he
should just open fire on me trying to go home.
Right. Right. So if you come out, if somebody says to you, hands up, and for whatever reason, the police officer thinks it's you, and you come out of the car with hands up, that should be the end of it. Right, James?
I got my hands up, and that's exactly what I would do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't think you should open fire on me 18 times or whatever, how many shots.
Right. 13 times. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's a hard job, and my thing is this. If you are that nervous being a police officer, maybe you shouldn't be there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's a big part of it, I think, James. I think I have a friend who was a former police chief of one of our towns around here. And I've spent many conversations with him. In fact, I should invite him back on the show because he's retired now. But his whole thing is that police officers spent way too much time training in how to use their weapon and not enough time in conflict resolution.
Yeah.
And that you know, if you're a hammer, you're always thinking about a nail. I have spoken with several different law enforcement professionals who believe that the issue is in the middle of the moment, in the heat of the moment, understanding temperament, reading body cues, taking view of the entire situation and ratcheting things down, not up.
Yeah, because my thing, I mean, like I said, I know it's a hard job. And, you know, every situation is different. But me being a citizen, that could, maybe I had a red Honda. Maybe that could have been me that night, just trying to get a midnight snack or whatever. I'm going home.
Yep.
I just don't think I deserve to be fired at Because I would have did exactly what he did. If I had got pulled over, I would have got out of the car with my hands up.
Sure.
I'd have made sure they see my hands.
Right.
Now, maybe my watch has got glitter on it or something. Maybe it sparkles and they think it's a gun.
Yeah.
But I just got my hands up. I just don't think I deserve to get shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just how I feel about it.
Yeah. Well, this officer was arraigned, and he's arraigned for a whole bunch of different charges. And if you're the police chief in Hamden, what do you think you would do with this officer in terms of having him stay on duty, off duty? What do you think you would do now that you've charged him with this kind of crime of excessive force?
He's off the force.
Yeah.
And here's my reason. If all your training, and I know you got to go through the academy and all these things, if all the training that you have and the best you can do is open fire on it, somebody who, well, you just said that they found no gun in the car or whatever, and just open fire like that, and I think one of the other officers got shot too.
Yes, he got shot. He got grazed by a bullet in what they call friendly fire, which is when you're shot by one of your own.
Well, in that instance, there could have been somebody else on the street.
Absolutely.
It's just danger. It's reckless.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, if that's the best you can do with your police training, like I said before, maybe you shouldn't be a cop. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be a police officer.
Yeah.
Because my thing is this. I have common sense, and I'm not a police officer, but I would have a lot of questions during my training of how to de-escalate situations because I don't want to get shot.
Yeah, exactly. That's true.
I would be more interested in how do I de-escalate, what's the best way to de-escalate a situation.
Yeah.
And the main thing is public safety, and that's what it's supposed to be about. And that was reckless because he could have shot, and bullets could have went through somebody's house.
Sure.
There's a lot of things that could have happened that night. It just so happens that the girl passenger got shot, and there's no evidence he did anything.
No,
so.
And thank God, exactly, and thank God she didn't get killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I just think with the training, I hear too many times with police officers, well, I thought he had a gun. I thought I saw something, and I opened fire 12 times. Well, that's not good enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, if you're supposed to be there to protect them, so they got to do a better job to me. I'm sorry.
James, what do you do?
I'm retired. I had a dry cleaning business.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm a law-abiding citizen my whole life, and I've always thought about that. But I've never been in that situation. But I was like, wow, if I'm just going home, I think I should be able to just go home.
Yeah.
And if I got pulled over, okay, maybe I might say a life was out or something. That's okay. But I don't think I deserve to get shot because you saw something.
Thank you, James. Appreciate the call. Thanks for listening. Thanks for contributing today. Appreciate it.
Love your show.
Thank you. It's 1042-203-333-9422. We've got lots of things to talk about. I got something on my mind I want to share. There's a feature that I like to do a lot on the show called Who Died Today? And a woman died that I happened to meet very, very briefly in Washington, D.C. years ago. Her name was Kay Hagan, and she was a North Carolina senator. She succeeded Elizabeth Dole. She only had one term of 6 years. But she was very young and beautiful and bright when I knew her. And I saw that she died, and I gasped because I knew that she had to still be pretty young, and she was only 66. And the reason I wanted to talk about her death is because she died of a rare tick disease. She died of Powassan virus, which is one of these tick-borne diseases that we rarely discuss because we're mostly spending most of our time thinking about Lyme. But Ms. Hagan contracted encephalitis and contracted this tick-borne Powassan virus 3 years ago and had a deterioration of her she had neurodegeneration for the last 3 years. She largely had to stay out of the public eye. She lost the ability to control her muscles, arms and legs, and her speech. She was in a wheelchair for a long time. And I was just shocked because she got this from walking in the woods, probably in North Carolina. We have a lot more ticks in Connecticut. And it is tick season. It's been a spectacular fall, but really good for ticks because it's this, it's actually been a little warm for ticks, but cool enough for them to thrive. And not too long ago, about a month ago, I was in my own kitchen and my friend was visiting me, Sandy, and I was scratching at something on my face. And I said, Sandy, what is that? And she looked at it and she grabbed a pair of tweezers and a tick had attached itself to my cheek. Now, hopefully it hadn't been there too long. It couldn't have been. It was on my face. But I'd never had a tick attached to my cheek before. And right away, I took doxycycline for 48 hours because I don't care what the doctors say. I'm still taking doxycycline for 48 hours. Even if I have to beg, borrow, or steal it from a veterinarian, I'm taking doxycycline for the first 48 hours after knowing that a tick attached to my face. Because if you take doxycycline for the first 48 hours, you dramatically drop your chance of getting any tick-borne disease. And even though the doctors don't always like to prescribe it, it's my view, I'm a DWD, I'm a doctor without a diploma, that this is the best thing to do rather than be safe than sorry. But I was just shocked. This rare Powassan virus, maybe it's not as rare as we thought. At the time when Kay Hagan won, she was involved in the most expensive Senate race in history. It topped $100 million for her Senate race. And ultimately, after one term, she lost. She was a Democrat. She lost to a Mr. Tillis, who was Speaker of the State House, by 1.7 percentage points, making North Carolina, you know, still a swing state. Occasionally, Democrats win. But she was a lovely, bright lady. After her loss, she became a resident fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. She was utterly charming. She was a lawyer. And I just was thinking about her. Because only 6 cases of the Powassan virus were reported in the United States in 2015 when she contracted the disease. Now, how can it be possible that somebody like this got the disease and died from it and only 6 cases were reported? Statistically, it seems highly improbable to me. What seems far more probable is that people have the disease, but they don't have the right diagnosis for it and they think something else is wrong. And in fact, what happened to her was, here's what happened to her. The family surmised that Ms. Hagan picked up the tick when they were hiking in the Blue Ridge Mountains. They say they think they were hiking in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. You know, the Blue Ridge Mountains goes all the way down. And Virginia borders North Carolina. They think that she got it in 2016, having a picnic on the grass. They don't remember specifically her ever being bitten. But by early December, one side of her face was drooping. And her husband thought that Kay Hagan had suffered a stroke. She got the immediate diagnosis of encephalitis, but because the Powassan virus is seen so rarely, it took doctors over 2 months to identify it. And unfortunately, the disease has no known treatment or vaccine, and over time, she deteriorated terribly, and she just died. And I'm thinking about this because we've done a lot of different stories, and we've had a lot of people on from the Global Lyme Alliance and other tick-borne people, you know, people that are doctors and familiar with all of this. So this is what I want to say to you. Of all the tips that I personally have ever heard that made sense to me about ticks, because I'm not going to change my life and not go outside. I have a dog. We walk. I always brush out the dog. I check her for ticks, but she's a little white cotton fluff. So we're not talking a lot of ticks. And when we have them, they're easy to spot and they're easy to see. But I'm going to still be walking out in the woods. But here's what I do. Number one, I never, ever, ever walk without really unattractive, white, thick socks that go up above my pants when I walk. And I have been told from time to time, Lisa, what are you doing in those socks? You look a little ridiculous. And I don't care. So I wear a shoe and a sock. In other words, I don't show any skin, even in the summer. I don't walk in the woods in shorts, in other words. I'll walk in workout pants and socks and sneakers. And then what I do when I'm not lazy is as soon as I go in the house, I throw everything in the dryer for 20 minutes because the tick people have told me that ticks will die when exposed to the heat of your dryer. So if you throw your clothes in the dryer when you come back from a walk, you know, assuming you have not already had a tick attached to you, you will kill any tick that might be walking around on your clothing that hasn't attached to you yet. And that's sort of like a good fail-safe habit to get into after you take a walk. And I do it pretty often. I throw my socks, my pants, my shirt, everything goes in the dryer for 20 minutes to kill whatever insect may have been crawling around. It's 8 minutes before the hour, 203-333-9422, The Lisa Wexler Show. Lots more coming up. And welcome back. It's 8 minutes before the hour. We've spent a fair amount of time today talking about the Stratford police, talking about the Hampden police case. We've got Henry from Stratford who'd like to comment. Hi, Henry. Welcome to the show today. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Lisa.
Sure.
I just wanted to commend you for bringing up the topic.
Oh, thank you.
And I wanted to let you know that I do believe that, given the information that I have, that seemingly it was excessive force. But I wanted to frame the whole situation by sharing with you the trauma that I've gone through and what defensive mechanisms I must put together, even though I've been a law-abiding citizen for years.
Go ahead. Tell me, Henry.
I have two. I happen to be African-American.
Okay.
I have two sons who are now grown.
Yeah.
And five grandsons.
Okay.
I have always taught them to be respectful of officers. I have a nephew who's a police officer, cousins in the FBI.
Wow.
So I do have family members who have been officers from Philadelphia to New York to New Haven, Connecticut. However, despite that and my values of being a law-abiding citizen, I must train my kids to keep their hands on the wheel, to follow what the officers say, and to try for their safety, always to have an ID. Despite that, I wanted to share an incident that happened to me back in the 70s.
Okay.
Back in the 70s, an officer DeJoseph was killed in Bridgeport. And I had a black and gray Pontiac Le Mans. My wife asked me not to take the car out, but I had to go get air in my tire. This happened in the town of Stratford. I was bent down, putting air in my tire. When I stood up, there were about two or three black and white cars, police officers, facing me, nosed in, with their guns drawn. You can imagine what kind of traumatic experience that had for
me. Scared to death.
And my oldest son was in a car seat in the back of the car.
In the car seat, so he was a baby.
He was a baby. He's now grown. Needless to say, I was quite traumatized. They didn't say anything to me.
Did they yell at you, put your hands out? Or
nothing.
So what were they doing surrounding you? I don't understand.
I don't know, and I'll never know.
Oh.
I'll never know.
Oh.
There have been other incidents where my sons, but they withdrew and they left.
They left. So they were investigating you, maybe because maybe they had to report you, your car, or you looked like somebody they were looking for. Is that possible,
yes,
Henry?
I believe my car was similar to the description of the car they were looking for.
Yeah, they're doing their job.
But there was, within a second, I could have been gone or my child could have been gone.
Yeah, you felt the danger. I felt the danger,
and I feel it every day. And I have to pray for my sons and my grandsons that they can follow and come home safely.
Let me ask you, Henry, I want to ask you a question because it's interesting to me. You said you had a nephew who went into law enforcement.
Oh, yes.
And I assume he's black as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what was in his head, do you think, to go into law enforcement?
Well, that was his, I'm not sure, but that was his choice. It was a profession.
No, it's a great profession, but I'm just wondering if, you know, what he was thinking in terms of maybe being in that situation and giving other African American members of the community more of the benefit of the doubt. I'm just wondering if you knew what was in his head in terms of trying to maybe correct the status quo as he experienced it.
Well, I really don't know what was in his head, but I do know that he's always been an outstanding young man.
Yeah.
He went to college and graduated, and he's always wanted to do what was fair by people.
Yeah.
But I also know that he is in a very difficult situation because at times there are other officers who really don't culturally understand the communities that they serve. And he has to walk a thin line.
Mm.
So he has to try to garner the respect of the people in the community while also fending off the racial and cultural ignorance of some of his colleagues.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult situation.
Yeah, yeah. I think to the extent that police officers have a community, whatever their community is, and we're a pretty multicultural country, we all need to try and understand cultural background, because it's those unspoken cues that are so much of communication, and that really, if we miss that, can lead to so many problems, Henry.
I concur with you 100%.
Yeah.
So, I appreciate you airing it. I also had a situation where my youngest son was followed home, and this was shortly after he graduated from college, and he was just coming home. And cars followed him to my house.
Wow.
For no apparent reason. And they were very disrespectful to my wife when she went down to defend my son.
Wow.
So that's the type of environment that I think that many people don't understand.
Yeah.
That especially African-American people who want to be outstanding and have the values of everybody else,
mm-hmm.
we just have to live under that guise where we also have to walk a thin line.
Yeah. What you're really saying is that it's a double standard, and that the standard that holds true for white people is not the same for blacks, so you have to be extra careful.
That's correct.
That's what I'm hearing.
Thank you for paraphrasing.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Henry, I'm really glad you called. I invite you to call again. I think that these conversations are really important.
I do also, and I would ask that you continue them.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Henry from Stratford on the Lisa Wexler Show. We've got another hour coming up. We've got an author joining us. She's talking about a pretty racy book that she wrote, but it's getting a lot of accolades and a lot of attention. And I've got a lot more stories to throw your way, because I really want to hear what you have to say about them. 203-333-9422. It's the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600 and WICC600.com.